With our guest tonight, Paul Smith, and what are some of those obstacles that there are out there to predicting the future? That's just one of the many things we'll talk with Paul about when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Paul, you were right in the middle of telling us some of the obstacles there are to predicting the future, and then the clock got us.
Yes, that darn clock. It's all about time, isn't it?
It is all about time.
Yeah. Well, of course, the nature of time is the first thing, at least the nature of the future. The next thing is, of course, how to properly task to do the future. A lot of folks, when they set up to try and use their psychic skills or remote viewing or whatever it might be to predict the future, they do it front-loaded. And so they have this notion of what they're trying to capture, and that in itself kind of pollutes the process. Because then all their conjectures, the inferences they can draw, the things they already know about the present and they might extrapolate into the future, all that's right there. And that clouds the whole issue. It's kind of ironic, but you can't know what you're trying to do or you'll mess up what you're trying to do.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's an obstacle. Another one has to do with the fact that there are actually different kinds of events. Now, remember, I talked about time. We don't care what the nature of time is, really. What we care about are the events that happen in time.
And what do you mean by different kinds of events?
Well, this gets into a little bit of philosophy and metaphysics, but that's okay. I'm going to use some gold-plated words here, but I'll explain them as best I can.
Sure.
The world, in general, works on what's called determinism, right? So we are in a deterministic universe, by and large, and I'll talk about exceptions in a second. What that means is, you can boil it down basically to, it has to do with the laws of cause and effect. There's no event that doesn't have a cause, and that cause has a preceding cause, and that cause has a preceding cause, and you can trace all the causal linkages all the way back to the Big Bang, presumably, right? So, in a deterministic universe, everything has been decided by the beginning conditions of the universe. In our case, the Big Bang, the forces and the values that were created when the Big Bang occurred, assuming the Big Bang is really how the universe started.
Right, which is doubtful on my end.
Yeah, but it certainly is the consensus in science.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so
yes,
we'll stick to that for now.
Of course, the consensus in science would also say remote viewing doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's right. Also true. So, that's a different discussion.
See?
We have. At any rate, given the Big Bang, the conditions and the settings, if you will, of how the universe is going to be have already been decided at that point. And then it's just a matter of very complicated unfolding of these causal chains into the future. And what that means is, if the universe were only deterministic, you could take a slice of it at any given point in time. Just let's say you've got this time stream of the universe's history unfolding. If you sliced it at any point there, and if you were smart enough to know all the laws of the universe and all the values of all the variables that existed, you could predict down to the absolute atom the entire state of the universe at any point forward in time and any point backward in time. That's a fully deterministic universe. There's no surprises in a deterministic universe except to someone who didn't know enough about it. Okay.
All right.
Because it doesn't, its end is predetermined by its beginning. Okay. That's really quite boring if you ask me. But nonetheless, we don't live in a purely deterministic universe. Because of quantum physics, which has some indeterminism at its core, and because some other macro events are indeterministic, there are some things that can't be predicted. Now, when I say indeterminism, that's, of course, the opposite of determinism. You could say randomness, if you want, instead of indeterminism, okay? So randomness, there is a certain bit of randomness that gets into the universe, thanks to quantum physics and some other kinds of events. And they have an impact on the universe, which makes part of it not completely predictable. Because if you have a random event, the effects that result from that, you aren't going to know in advance what's going to happen there because of the nature of randomness.
Right. You shouldn't be able to.
Yes. Now, of course, generally, the random events that happen at the quantum level get damped out by the bigger events in the deterministic universe. So, you know, there's all these little indeterminate things going on at the quantum level down there amongst all the little particles that are jostling around. But But when you have a whole bunch of them together, they tend to kind of damp out that unpredictability. But not completely. There's still a certain amount of unpredictability in the universe. Okay. So now, if that's all that the universe was, and we're talking about time here as well, then you still, in principle, ought to be able to predict down the time stream pretty well. However, that's not all there is to it. There's a further kind of event. Okay, you've got the deterministic events, you've got the indeterministic events. There's also what I call the intentional events, or you might call them non-deterministic events, but we'll call them intentional events. Now, there's some room for some confusion here. When I say an intentional event, I don't necessarily mean that someone intentionally causes
the event.
Right. So, in other words, a murder is one kind of intentional event. Somebody goes out and intentionally shoots somebody.
Right.
Okay. But there are intentional events that don't involve somebody intending something, which is confusing, but I'll explain. When I say intentional event, I mean anything that involves human intentionality. And so if someone makes a choice or makes a decision that accidentally results in somebody's death, they didn't intend to kill that person. But because their desires, their wants, their needs, their intentions were involved in it, it's still an intentional event.
Somebody decides they're going to make a right-hand turn. They didn't see the bicyclist on the right. Mm-hmm. They ram right into him. They kill him. Mm-hmm. They didn't intend to kill him.
That's right.
But they did. Their future actions killed a poor guy.
And it's still an intentional event because it involves their conscious activity.
Right.
Okay. So I hope that's clear. It sounds like it is, so that's good. Okay, so that is what I call the eccentricity wheel in the time stream. Okay, now an eccentricity wheel is in a clockwork mechanism. For various reasons, they may add this wheel that just does some odd things, that messes things up, changes things around. That's what intentional events do. And those can also cause trouble. They're also an obstacle to predicting the future because intentional events are by nature generally unpredictable because there is a certain amount of eccentricity in every human that you don't always know how their intentions are going to affect events in the future.
There are some, though, who simply say you can't change the future. It's not possible.
Yes.
Why do they feel that way? They're so strong against that.
Some of them are folks who don't believe that human intentionality is non-deterministic. Some folks think that inevitably what's going to happen is going to happen. In fact, I'm reading this book by Daniel Dennett, who's a quite well-known philosopher mm-hmm. and quite an engaging writer. He tells this tale I'd heard before. It's kind of a fable or something from the Middle East, right? It talks about this guy in Baghdad. And his servant goes to the market and then comes rushing home pale and frightened and says, I need to borrow your horse, I need to borrow your horse. And the master says, well, okay, you can borrow my horse, but what's the problem? He says, I have to ride to another city, I forget the name of the city, because I ran into Death at the market, and Death said Death has an appointment with me this evening, and I need to get as far away as I can. And so then the master goes to the market, finds Death, and says, why did you terrorize my servant like that? What do you mean? Well, he said, when he saw you, you made a threatening gesture. And Death says, well, I didn't make a threatening gesture. I reacted with surprise. I was surprised, and he said, what do you mean? I was surprised to see him here in Baghdad when I have an appointment with him in this other city tonight. But that captures kind of the notion that time is not changeable, right? And in fact, if human intention is just a product of our brains are slightly deterministic systems. If human intentions are just a product of us, we're just meat machines, as some people say, then intentions don't even confuse things. And they're just more complicated deterministic events. And so those kind of folks will think that you can't change the future and that, in principle, were you able to, you could predict the future pretty much 100% if you were that good. Right?
Would you call it intuitiveness as well, as opposed to remote viewing into the future? Or predicting the future?
Yeah, you could call it that. Now, here's the reason I'm reluctant, though, to do that, is because intuition involves two elements. One is the one that mainstream science talks about when they talk about intuition, and that is the fact that you notice things, your senses pick up things that are below the liminal threshold and you're not aware of. And yet those things still work, and you make decisions and you take actions based on that. Those things. They're like hunches. You don't know why you're deciding not to do something or to do something. You just do. But they're based on some real, just physical input. But I think, as do many other people, that intuition has this other component, which is the ESP or psi or whatever you want to call it. That component of intuition, which does, then that would match what you're talking about. But you always have to be careful when you say intuition to distinguish what you actually mean by that because of these two, this kind of ambiguous sort of notion.
Well, that's true. That's true. But it could be construed as remote viewing if you're good at what you do.
Yeah. As long as it has that non-physical, so to speak, that ESP component.
The state of getting into that mode, is it meditation, relaxation? What does it?
Well, that's, of course, a question that gets batted around a lot. In fact, you don't even have to apply it to remote viewing the future or being psychic about the future. Anytime you're trying to get into ESP mode, some folks think that you have to cultivate a certain mindset, a certain brainwave frequency, a certain state of relaxation. Generally, the research shows that, at least as far as remote viewing goes, you don't have to necessarily do that. It seems to work at about any set of EEG kind of patterns. It seems to work to some degree no matter what your agitation level is. Obviously, if you're too agitated, you're not going to be able to settle down enough to actually do it. But in general, it even doesn't matter too much the environment. Obviously, a very noisy environment is going to be distracting. That might make it hard to do. But in general, a remote viewer who is well-trained, again, and has experience can pretty much work in most conditions, which is good.
Is there a downside to predicting the future?
Actually, yes.
See, I don't see any.
Well, let's look at why people might want to do it. People might want to predict the future because it allows them to anticipate negative things are coming, or it allows them to take advantage of opportunities that might be coming their way. Or it may allow them to position themselves strategically to accomplish something that they want to accomplish. And all those things work in their favor. But now there are a couple of interesting potential downsides to knowing what the future is. The first one is, suppose that there's an event that's going to occur that you can do absolutely nothing about. And you know about it.
All right, let's say like a tornado is going to destroy your house.
Yes.
You can't move your house.
Well,
you can move your body, but you can't move
now,
your house.
Now, of course, it would be advantageous in that circumstance. But let's say some folks like to remote view their deaths, right? Well, let's say you accurately remote view your death. You know how and when you're going to die.
Okay.
Let's say you could do that, right? I'm dubious that you can, but let's say you can. What's that going to do to you in the here and now when you're supposed to be living your life? Many folks would get so wrapped up in when they're going to die and how they're going to die that they might actually tend to throw them in a catatonic kind of a state.
Well, yeah, but if someone predicts that they're going to die of cancer,
mm-hmm.
don't you think then that they would take those steps to try to avoid that if they could?
Well,
and it would help them?
Yes, but see, now you're talking, you're talking just psychologically, where even if it wouldn't help them, just doing something helps, that gives them some
promise and hope.
Yeah. Well, of course, in that case, they don't actually know they're going to die. It's been predicted they're going to die, but they think that maybe they aren't going to.
Well, they fight the good fight.
Right, they do. Now, so I'm talking about a circumstance where you absolutely know what's going to happen, and you absolutely know there's nothing you can do about it.
All right, regardless of what you do then in the present form,
right,
you already see the outcome.
There's actually some psychology experiments. The behaviorists did this with rats. Rat in a cage, you shock the rat, and the rat knows it's going to get shocked because there's always this little buzzer that goes off, right? This is just one kind of experiment.
Yeah.
They were testing what happened. There's a buzzer goes off, and then there's a shock. And the rat's in the cage. There's no place to hide. There's no place to get away with it. They just get shocked. And it really messes them up, let me tell you, because they can't do anything. You know, they just live in anticipation of this shot.
They hate it.
Yes, and it basically destroys them psychologically, right? And I think that if you knew something was going to happen that was very bad and you could not do it and you knew you could not do anything about it, then that would be a problem. That would definitely
See, I come from the school, Paul, where you can do something about it.
Right. Which, of course...
Does that make me different?
No. Most people think that you can do something about the future, because even the people who don't think you can change the future oftentimes sort of harbor this sort of irrational belief that you can change the future.
I mean, it's like the Christmas Carol with Scrooge peeking through the window at Tiny Tim with the spirit of the future.
Yes.
And he says, are these, you know, things that will be or can be and or shall be? And I will always believe... You can control the outcome.
Well, see, Dickens was not a determinist, and neither are you.
No, exactly.
And neither am I, as a matter of fact. Now, I think there are things that you cannot change in the future. Those are large-scale deterministic events. In fact, there's lots of small-scale deterministic events that can't be changed. One example might be that tsunami that hit.
Mm-hmm. Okay? The one in Indonesia.
The one in Indonesia, because that's such a massive... event. And now we're getting into the catastrophe stuff that we were kind of, that I was teasing people with, you know, before.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get into that. That is a deterministic event. Now, there might have been indeterministic components, because who knows what's going on down, you know, miles below the crust and all that, right? But nonetheless, the general conditions for the earthquake that caused the tsunami were set long ago, and they were pretty much inevitably going to happen.
Right.
They laid across a whole bunch of timelines. Okay, they were inevitably going to happen. The tsunami itself is a deterministic result of that event, of the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was going to happen given the conditions that did exist. There's nothing you can do about that. That was there.
However, you could have gotten out of there.
Let's talk about... In fact, two ways to change the future, because that comes in here too, right? There's two ways to change the future if you know in advance what the future is going to be. The first way is to change the event. And that doesn't work on a deterministic style event.
Right.
Unless you have more resources at your disposal,
sure,
than the event itself is large.
So in this case, you can't change the event.
It's just too big. It's just too big. So you can't change that event. So the other thing you can change is your reaction or your pre-action with regard to that event. So if there's an event you can't change, but you can change your behavior in some way to avoid the event or to ameliorate the consequences of that event, then that's another way you have of changing the future, at least your particular future. Now, when you talk about changing the future, we're not talking about changing the entire time stream. To do that, you'd have to alter the entire course of the entire universe, right? We're talking about altering certain parts of the time stream that are downstream from where you are. Okay, so when we're changing the future, we're only really changing part of the future.
Well, now, you don't have to change much.
You don't.
If you can get out of Dodge in time.
That's exactly right. Although, think about it, even changing a little changes a lot, because you have a sort of a butterfly effect downstream from the future as well. You change one little thing here, and it has this little ripple effect, because you change the thing here, that changes the things that would have been different otherwise. Those in themselves then change things that would also have been different, and it just cascades to where you have a whole side of the time stream that's dramatically affected if you go far enough out.
All right, stay with us, Paul Smith. We're going to be joined for just a moment with remote viewer Ed Dames as well on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Smith with us. And remote viewer Major Ed Dames joins us for about a half hour in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Paul Smith with us for the duration of the program. Joining him for this half hour, Major Ed Dames as well. Ed, how are you?
I'm good. And yourself, George?
Good. Good to have you with us. Paul's with us, too. The heavy hitters here of remote viewers. Ed, big Stephen Fawcett news tonight. I wanted to get your reaction to it. Paul, jump in anytime you want as well. Newspaper in the United Kingdom saying that they are thinking that Stephen Fawcett may have faked his death. I find that unlikely. I want to get your thoughts on that, Ed.
The man had too much integrity to ever do anything like that, period.
That's what I thought, too. I thought, you know, it's just bizarre that they can't find him. We're trying to get your coordinates to this group that's out there looking for him right now.
I think
it's a mess.
We're going to do that ourselves. I think if you want something done right, you do it yourself. That old saw holds true, and we're quietly going in.
Very good. Paul, we've got Ed here. We've got you here, remote viewing. Ed, you predict a lot in the future, some of it pretty scary. That's how they call you, Dr. Doom. Paul, you're not as catastrophic as Ed. How come?
No. Well, I don't know actually how that reflects on Ed. I'm not as catastrophic as Ed. That's pretty good.
I know that. I like that.
Hey, Ed, by the way, good hearing from you again.
It's good to hear you, too. I caught the last 30 minutes of your show. I was up late dealing with a child murder case in Oklahoma. But I turned on the radio, and I was very interested in what you were saying. I'd like to add two examples empirically of my work over the last 25 years, things that I noticed that may add to the context of your conversation, if I may.
Sure, Ed.
One is, I agree with Paul about deterministic events, and if you're not bigger than them, you're not going to stop them. But as a remote viewer, you can see them very easily, and you can many times wiggle your way out if you know they're coming. So I'm total agreement there. But two things I noticed that were very, very interesting vis-a-vis the topic at hand. If I attempt to remote view where, let's say, you, George, are going to eat dinner tonight. Now, there's some preconceived notions there that you're still alive to eat dinner and that you will eat dinner somewhere. But let's say you plan on going to a restaurant.
Okay.
If I can actually remote view your future and see you at that restaurant, unless there's any intention whatsoever that I will tell you what my results are. If I plan upon doing that, I can't succeed in remote viewing the restaurant. That's a paradox we run into.
Why is that?
I don't know. I don't have the answers. It's just something we run into empirically. And the other thing is that a very interesting case. In a couple of cases of very, very serious maladies, breast tumors, for instance, I know there were two cases of where women had breast tumors that were all of a sudden gone the next day and doctors could not understand what happened. That was very intriguing to me, and I subjected that particular event to remote viewing, and what I found was that angels were actually operative in those cases, and the way they cured the tumor was not in real time. They were moving back into the future, and they stopped the tumor from happening in the first place in the past.
Angels, are you getting spiritual on us now, Ed?
No, it's not spiritual. It's not supernatural either. It's not maybe transcendental, but there's no really supernatural. Everything's natural. I'm telling you, the angels are real. We can remote view them, and that in those cases, that's what was happening. So, in terms of time, you can put that in your pipe and smoke it for what it's worth.
And I have to say, it sounds like you have been smoking something. But anyway,
no. Just like we used to do, huh, Paul?
Well, I don't know about we.
Here they go. Not a debate.
You've really got yourself into a fix here, George.
Not a debate. 17 more minutes to go with Ed. So
they're going to drag on like an eternity.
Nah,
no, just kidding.
You guys are friends now.
Yeah.
Paul and I have had some very, very, in the military, some interesting things. One thing that Paul did was actually remote view the Ark of the Covenant. I think that of all the things that Paul and I have done together in the military unit, that was the most profound event in terms of a training project. Using tax dollars, he actually pulled that off. Quite exciting.
What was the need to find the Ark of the Covenant on a government basis? What did they want that for?
No, it was an advanced training session what you want to do is throw all kinds of various and sundry targets at a viewer so they never attempt to guess or fall into an ennui about what the target may be. So you throw them everything.
You know what's so great about just having you two on for even this moment is because it clears up a lot of people who will send emails to me, Ed, or to Art that says, come on, Ed Dames doesn't know Paul Smith, or Paul Smith doesn't know Ingo Swann, Ed Dames doesn't know Hal Putoff. it's good to know that you guys do know each other.
Oh, yeah.
And that you've worked together.
And we, you know, we disagree profoundly in a lot of areas, but we can disagree and still be friends.
Correct. So. Absolutely.
Were you, too, when you were doing your military work, was there a point where there was some frustration on both your parts at what they were asking you to do? I mean, did you want to break loose from that and say, what are we doing? We should be doing this. You first, Paul.
Well, as a viewer, that's a really tough question to answer because, frankly, I didn't know what I was doing. You know, viewers, by definition, aren't supposed to be told what they're doing in their sessions. And so you end up doing all kinds of stuff, and you only find out, sometimes you don't even find out until years later what the project was you're working on. So it's hard to say. I would say I never was frustrated. Now, that's, of course, why Ed could get away with things like running us on the Ark of the Covenant, because we had to be blind up front. You could get tasked on any target. It could be anything, and you wouldn't have any say in it because you were just blind to it. You just went and did it, right? Now, after the fact, of course, sometimes you did know what it was, particularly on training kinds of targets. So I have to say the Ark of the Covenant sessions were pretty interesting because I can tell you I really was blind on that target. I had no idea I was being run on the Ark of the Covenant. And when I got done, the results were fairly consistent with the part of the testing about the arc that I was supposed to do. So,
what did it look like?
Well,
in your opinion,
it I drew sketches of it. Right, I didn't know I was doing the arc. I didn't even call it the arc when we were done. But if you go in and you look at it, you see the sketches, and they in profile pretty much looked very similar to what the arc is presumed to look like.
Were you able to find where it was?
I actually described its location, which was, I have to go back and look at the session now. But as I recall, it was underground in a Middle Eastern city. So very much like where it was depicted as being in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Some believe it's still in Jerusalem somewhere.
Well, that's actually, I had an AOL. You're familiar with that term. Maybe some of the listeners aren't. I had analytical overlay, my left brain suggesting something which may or may not have been true, but I had an AOL of Jerusalem in that session, so maybe, you know, it's hard to say.
Ed, were you conducting the training, or were you part of the training at that time?
No, I was. At that time, we used monitors. A monitor, at that time, I was the operations and training officer, so I was an operations officer, and when we had downtime, then I could throw, in order to keep our viewers up to battle snuff, you know, we'd throw them anything. So I could choose the targets, UFOs, the Ark of the Covenant, those kinds of things. And it was pretty exciting to do that. And it could get fairly boring just to look inside of missile silos and things like that. So we wanted to keep novelty acts as a stimulus in terms of remote viewing.
And you were an expert at novelty, that's for sure.
Oh, thank you. I resemble that.
Was he a tough boss, Paul?
Well, Ed didn't count as our boss. He was one of the workers along with us. He just had a different role. But he, you know, he would try and raise the bar, you know.
Innovation.
Let me interrupt you a little bit. I want to tell you, George, that one of the topics for discussion tonight was whether or not you need a warm-up to remote view. And Paul addressed that correctly. Different strokes for different folks. What Paul used to do, and he probably does not want to admit this, is 30 minutes before a session, he would go into, we had a warm-up room, a very dark room, and he would listen to solid acid rock, AC/DC, those kinds of things like that. I'd have to wake him up, you know, and get him over into the viewing room to do his job.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't solid acid rock. I actually had other stuff on there. Like, I had even a couple of Dolly Parton songs, believe it or not.
Oh, why?
I'm glad you never told me that, Paul.
Ed, tell us a little bit, for new people, what you have talked about for years with Art about the kill shot. And then, Paul, I want your reaction to this futuristic event.
This is like the cage fight, right?
No, okay. Not really. Yeah, two go in, one comes out. Not yet. But that's not a bad idea one day.
Okay.
Kill shot, Mr. Dames.
It was most intriguing to look over the horizon because remote viewing in a disciplined fashion is a good over-the-horizon radar if it's used correctly. And we were always doing that, and viewers were running into catastrophic events in the future. Even in the military unit, there were in circumstances that I said in terms of advanced training or under the rubric of advanced training exercises, I would slip very, very good viewers. The best in the unit were Paul Smith, Mel Riley, were superb viewers. And blind targets having to do with the future, and they would describe truly catastrophic things. And that's where we began to run into disease and starvation, those kinds
right.
of scenarios. But later on, after I put together my own intelligence agency, the Matrix Intelligence Agency, because I got tired of the bureaucratic red
sure.
tape.
I can understand that.
I trained the civilian team, and then we kept continued to do that and started to bump up against this very, very geophysically very, very threatening on a global scale event. And after a lot of work, realized what it was, that the sun was going to go on a rampage. And that's the most catastrophic thing that we have seen or that my team has seen in at least the last 15 years.
And do you see this, Paul, or have you even looked at that?
Well, no.
Because he may be right. I think something's happening with the sun, and who knows what will happen as we get close to 2012.
You know, and this is where a bit of a challenging discussion could occur. Ed, of course, and maybe this is good. I think there's listeners who'd like this question asked. You've basically been predicting the kill shot for, 10 years now, and you've had different time frames on it, and yet it's never actually happened.
I predicted a shot across the bow. You know what the time problem is in our work, obviously. The shot across the bow, I said, would be a very large solar flare that would miss us. And that was 2 weeks prior to the largest solar flare in recorded history, I said that the sun's about to be going on a rampage and this is what's going to happen. So that was 2 weeks prior to that event. Now, for me, it's almost a moot point. I'm digging in because it could be 2 years, it could be 5 years, it could be eight or more, but that's still within my lifetime, and I'm preparing.
Well, first of all, I believe in being prepared, even if you don't have any intimations of the future, right? And of course, I'm Mormon, and Mormons, you know, they have they believe in storing food for
sure.
emergencies.
I'm aware of that.
Yeah, so I have this philosophy of being prepared. But, you know, again, to be a little difficult here perhaps, you've been digging in for a while, Ed.
I agree.
I have to walk that line between being Chicken Little and being Dr. Doom. And it's fine. It's difficult, but I've already said it. There's no need to say it anymore. Right now, you know, I'm a simple man. I'm back to simple things. But I'm prepared, and many of the people that I have trained, many of my students, are either prepared or preparing for that particular scenario because they can see it themselves because they've been trained as remote viewers.
And Paul, in remote viewing, when you look into the future in terms of dates, whether it's a year, two, three, do you need a reference point in order to know the date that this is occurring? Because in Ed's particular case, you can predict the kill shot. I'm going to talk about the sun in just a second because it is very strange right now.
Right.
But don't you need to see something like a calendar when you remote view in order to know where you are?
Well, obviously you need a reference point, some kind of coordinate system in order to tell you where you are in space and in time as well. That's how we set up our reckoning. We created a calendar, which is just an artificial kind of blueprint we lay over the time stream. So in order to know when something's going to be, you really do need some sort of landmark, or in this case, some kind of time mark. And now this is assuming even that you're on when you're doing it, that you're actually remote viewing some future event that is actually going to occur.
A deterministic event.
Yes.
In most cases.
Yeah. Well, actually, if you could... Yeah, you're right. That it has to be a deterministic event, or at least partially deterministic in some way.
Yeah, partially perhaps, yeah.
Yeah. So you're exactly right about that, George. And again, of course, I'm asking questions that lots of people want to ask Ed, so this is a golden opportunity. Okay.
No, there's no need for me to really.
He stands his ground.
No, I'm just saying that we. The problem that we have in our business is, well, first of all, nobody understands time.
Mm-hmm.
And mind is outside of time. Mind, if you think of time as the fourth dimension, allegorically speaking, then think of mind as the fifth dimension. It looks down on this broad panoply of events and sees the effects of one thing over here on another. Yes, there's some wiggle room in there, and things are wiggling around. So it's difficult for... We have no standard. We don't have a touchstone yet.
Yep.
Maybe we
and I would agree with that point. If you are predicting the future, actually capturing when some event like that is going to occur, if it's far enough down the time stream, is going to be hard to do if you don't have some reference point to triangulate from, so to speak.
Right.
The best that we can do is, and we can triangulate. Geographically, it took my team and I 20 years to figure that out, but in terms of time, I don't know on my watch if that's ever going to happen.
But here's the problem with all of that. The problem is that then one wonders whether the prediction is any consequence or any use, because the situation is very similar to the people who have these presentiments about some terrorist attack. Well, for example, one of my students is very interested in dream ESP and dream precognition, and she sends me all of these impressions she gets all the time, and most of them are just kind of inscrutable as to how they apply to anything, and they don't ever seem to come together, but every once in a while she get one. Like, for example, shortly after 9/11, this airliner crashes into a neighborhood in New York.
Mm-hmm.
She actually had a precognitive dream in which she had this impression of an airliner crashing into a neighborhood, into a city, urban landscape. Red, white, and blue were the colors, and it was American Airlines plane, as I recall. And she reported that to me, and she reported it to some other folks, but there was no specificity in it. And so there was absolutely nothing you could do about it.
Well, let me just illustrate one thing before I drop out of this conversation. For the last 10 years, my students have remote viewed what we call an optimum trajectory for themselves. And that turns out to be a really good remote viewing cue or search term. But about 7 years ago, in terms of an optimum trajectory, people were not describing an optimum mate, an optimum vocation, an optimum place to live and everything. Everybody was describing themselves underground, digging in and actually physically underground or in slot canyons.
Hiding.
Well, not hiding. Actually be protected from very high winds in places where there was a lot of fresh water, period.
Okay. Right.
Now, these are your students, did you say?
Yes, hundreds of them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, then a skeptic might ask the question, and I don't mean necessarily a skeptic of sight, just someone with you know, who's skeptical of the reports here, might say, but they know about you, they know that you've been predicting high winds, you've been predicting living underground since 1997, really.
Hey, Paul, we've got to run. We're at the top. You're going to stay with us. We're going to take phone calls, continue talking with you about dowsing. Remote viewer Ed Dames, his website will be linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Great predictions. That, of course, always back for full programs. I'll be back in a moment.